Yeah, well, thanks for inviting me. It's apologize for not being able to stay much longer, but anyway. So this talk will be, as you'll see, and hopefully I'll I won't overwhelm you too much with lots of things. I wanted to give a full overview of all the different science aspects of this sample that we've been working on the follow-up from it for the last 5 or 6 years now. So I want to really give a full overview of what's in there without going in a few parts into depth. But the whole idea is to give a bit of a starting point for discussions, both today, but also tomorrow and the day after. So come and see me. I'm in, I think, room 1104. Do you remember? You're my office. 1108. Yeah. I've spent like 5 minutes in that office. I think that's the point, right? To just interact. So just to say that all the work here is done in a collaboration. It's not a very big collaboration. So just to put it clear, this is, it says the SPT, the South Pole Telescopes, but this is actually a subgroup of the South Pole Telescope, the ones working, well, this is actually submillimeter galaxies is actually the word we want to try to avoid because they're not submillimeter, they're millimeter selected. We'd rather call them dusty star forming galaxies, but the name stuck from the beginning. So, but anyway, it's this group of about 20 people, 15, 20 people who have come together. So it's led by Joaquin Vieira, who's somewhere in this picture. Oh, wait, there he is. And a few others. So I'll show basically this picture, zoom outs from it whenever. Highlight people that have done the work, because especially the grad students, Maria Strandet, Bitten Gulberg, and Jason Spilker have done a lot of the work, but not only, but they really are very active. So just to be a quick overview before you lose the overview during my talk. So I'll introduce a little bit the nature of these dusty star-forming galaxies from the South Pole Telescope. And introduce a little bit on the lensing models, because they're gravitationally lensed objects, which make them so bright, allowing us to do lots of physics and detailed studies that are thus far impossible with single disk cells. But even with ALMA, we can do more things than you could do with unlensed objects. I'll give quite some emphasis on the redshift search and the redshift distribution, which is one of the things that I'm more closely involved in. And also what I'm closely involved in is the work on the C-plus lines of that was led by my former student, Bitten Gulberg, now at Durham. And then in the end, I'll show some different aspects of other lines, also CO lines, but also mostly on the fine structure lines. So that'll be roughly the outline. So where do these sources come from? Well, from the South Pole Telescope. It says obviously where this telescope is based. So it's a collaboration. It's a US-led thing with lots of funding from the NSF. I've heard there's a site visit from the NSF, so I think should acknowledge a lot of the effort that they've put in and the US South Antarctic program, which allowed to put a big telescope there, and they do a lot of the logistics. Apparently, it's, I haven't been there myself, but this is really quite a good support that they get there. So the whole idea of this project led, this whole telescope was led by John Constum in the University of Chicago, was both a cosmological survey to do cosmology parameters and also to use the AZ effect for galaxy clusters. So they'd done a whole survey. There's actually already two generations of instruments there. This first AZ-1 and then SPT Pole, and now they're doing a third generation instrument. So what I'm talking is from the first generation survey, which covered 2,500 square degrees in the south, basically from declination minus 45 to minus 60 over a whole strip from 21 to 6 hours in RA. So the survey looks a bit like this. Of course, you can zoom into it. It's not very high spatial resolution. It's about several arc minutes resolution. So you see all these little fluctuations in here. They're both a Z effect and cosmological power spectrum fluctuations. But if you look closely into it, well, I should say that this camera works at three different wavelengths, at 3, 2, and 1.4 millimeters. Then if you zoom into an area of this, you see these little ripples here and point sources in them. And this is actually a color image based out of the three bands that we got. So basically the 3, 2, and 1.4 millimeter. So that's how you get the colors. And the ripples here are the CMB fluctuations and the AZ effect of from the clusters. Then the blue colors here, where blue means the 1.4 millimeter, the shortest wavelength, those are the sources which are dominated by the dust. So schematically, this is the spectral index distribution of these three objects. So you have a lot of sources where the peak around spectral index minus 0.7. Those are synchrotron dominated sources. And then you've got another peak with a spectral index between two highest frequencies here, which are consistent with dust, thermal dust on the Rayleigh gene side. So the slopes being, of course, completely opposite. So what we've done is to exclude the sources which have these spectral indices that are more radio dominated. So we take the ones that are dust dominated. We also done a radio bias somewhere. I'm not sure if I've written it down here, but basically from the SUMS survey, so the radio loud sources we've taken out. We come back to regret that a little bit because they can actually still be quite interesting sources. So we've now added them back a little bit to the sample as a separate subsample. But I won't talk about those today. And so in the end, we've got a bit more than 100 sources with 1.4 millimeter fluxes above 15 millijansky. So if you go down to the lower limit, we start getting a little bit of in the noisy part, but we're mostly interested in the bright point sources in here. So the idea is that these sources are really lensed, very bright, or either very lensed objects, like the normal dusty star forming galaxy selected in the millimeter, submillimeter, or they could be intrinsically very bright objects, but that they would be quite extreme objects in that case. So to get the SEDs, we actually have, to start with, we already have three wavelengths from the SPT itself. Then we followed them up to get better positions with the LaBoca instrument on APEX at 850 microns. And then we observed all of them with the three bands of Spire and three bands of PAX. So there we have SEDs here of all of our targets have 10 SED points on them. So we have got them very well covered, as you can see. The far infrared luminosities are very well determined of these objects. So that already kind of gives us a bit of an indication of the redshifts. We'll come back to that later. But there's a temperature dust redshift degeneracy in this. So I should say this work is one of our first papers by Thomas Graeber who did this. So I won't talk too much about stellar masses, but I wanted to at least show what we're doing. This is work done by a grad student in Florida, Jim Dimas. So the problem, of course, with lensed objects, and these objects are lensed mostly by foreground galaxies, not by galaxy clusters. So that makes it a bit complicated. So here, what we see here is an HST image with ALMA dust contours on it. With HST, you get nice enough spatial resolution, but that's not quite the ideal wavelengths for stellar distribution, so you rather want to use SPSR IRAC for this, but then the spatial resolution is not sufficient to subtract. So what we've done is made a model of the HST image, convolved it to the resolution of IRAC, then subtract this one from this one, or here you can see that the model gets cut out. These are the residuals, and these are the residuals of the IRAC. So you can still see this nice Einstein ring, and then you can determine stellar masses from it. It's a bit complex, but it does seem to work. So then we have here the, we've done this for a number of objects, so they get the specific star formation rates here. In red are R points, so this goes out to redshift 6 almost now. So these objects seem to be on the high end of the main sequence. They're a little bit above it, I would say, but they're not really in the full merging, they're not like factors of 5 or 6 above, they're more like a factor of 2 or 3 above the main sequence, or sometimes could be consistent with being on them.
So you assume that the gravitational mass is dominated by stars in analyzing this thing?
The lens?
For the lens.
No, so what we see here, this is the foreground lens, of course. In the optical, that's the foreground lens, and what we are interested in for the stellar mass is not the mass of the lens, it's the mass of the background lens object. Yeah. So in the submillimeter, we actually see the background lens object. And in the optical, we see the foreground lens. Yeah. So we want to get rid of the foreground lens to actually measure this.
That was the redshifts of the lens.
The redshifts are around, on average, 0.8, almost 1.
And those are Fermi types?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, so they're relatively easy to model just with Galvin. Okay, so the lensing models itself, which is kind of the same plot here, but then looking at the other side, so rather than removing the lens, here we're trying to model the background lens object. So that's work done mostly by a grad student in Arizona, Justin Spilker. He's done really a lot of work taking the models from Jesser Hesave and supervisor and Moroni. So what you basically need is the ALMA data of like 0.5 arc seconds resolution. So they've taken this data and then modeled it here, and this is the full resolution of the model with the lensing caustic on it. So this is the source plane, so this is the kind of objects you get out of this. What is important, I won't go into great details of these lensing models because that's not my area of expertise, I must admit. I'd rather use the results of the lensing, but you can do a lot of other things with it. But what is important to keep in mind is that this is the lensing model that we do is done in the UV plane. So why didn't you do that in the image plane? Well, because in the UV plane, that's where you can properly take the uncertainties of the interferometer into account. So like for example, phase errors in your data, that's where what you want to fit. If you put that into your imaging model, and especially if you do any self-calc, you put your structure of your object into your data, and then you can actually, whatever you get in the lensing model is what you've done in your self-calibration of your ALMA data. So you don't want to do that, you want to do this fitting in the UV plane to do it correctly and have a good estimate of the real measurement errors. So sometimes we get like almost perfect Einstein rings in this. Sometimes it gets split up. We even have a case, I believe this is the one, where you actually have two lenses. You have a lens here and another lens here. So it's a double lens object with two foreground objects, where the second foreground object may even be lensed by the first foreground. So things can get quite complex with this. So what comes out of this lensing model is the source sizes and the magnification, the mu factor of these objects. So the amplifications go from almost zero, well actually one is an unlensed object, less than one would mean it fainted, so that doesn't make sense. But they go up to almost a factor of 30 amplified, so that really makes these objects are way brighter than if you wouldn't have the foreground lens. So that makes it allows you to do a lot of things on faint objects. And here what you get also out of it is the intrinsic sizes of the objects. So what you see is that the most compact objects, which are here on this side, they tend to have higher amplifications, which is kind of normal, because if you're very near the acoustic, if you have a compact object, that gets magnified more strongly. It's important to keep in mind that lensing amplifies, preserves surface brightness, so you just spread it out over a larger area. If you have a small object exactly on the acoustic, you get a large, so that kind of explains this trend here.
What is the difference between the two different kinds of data points?
So here the colored, the red points are sample, and these are the Herschel lens objects. Okay. So also Herschel did other surveys of kind of the same idea. Mm-hmm. I'll go back later to those very briefly. They're the same kinds of objects, only selected at different wavelengths.
They have the same vector distribution, so that you're sampling the same.
No, that's I have that later on.
The fact that you have a sample that has no magnification, right? Does mean that these are like truly very bright star forming galaxies?
No, they have magnification.
But yeah. They are at one, right? No, but some of these.
Some of them are not.
Are yeah, like so truly very bright.
We have a few objects where we think we don't see any indication that they're gravitationally enhanced from deep optical or Spitzer imaging. So there is a few objects, and Scott Chapman is also working on a few of these objects to have a separate paper on them, because they could be really high lurks, extremely high lurks. One of the brightest objects that could be around. So we have a few of those. Of course, it's easy to say that they are lens. Prove that they're unlens is actually the hardest part, because you can always have it hidden somehow.
Which ones of the sides? Which ones of the sides? This side, of course, what kind of, so stellar distribution or?
No, this is this is from ALMA. So this is the Rayleigh jeans side of the dust distribution that we always target. Yeah, but alpha, we basically discovered band 7, I think, or band 6. We did the same, yeah, band 7. We did the same 850 microns to compare it with La Boca to see if we had any growth. So the size distribution here is in red, is our distribution compared with the Herschel lens and the Elsevier lens from Scuba 2 and from the LES survey. So we see that our distribution is not all that different from the unlensed sources, which is interesting because it means that the distribution of these objects in sizes, the size distribution of these objects is not different than the ones from the unlensed sample. So that seems to be, they seem to be sampling the same kind of sources that are just brighter because the lens. We're not necessarily selecting different unrepresentative objects. They're just brighter thanks to the lensing. So the main thing with all this lensing is that they're just brighter and you can actually, they're also stretched. You have the lensing stretching. So that's what we did. This is actually with ATCA, the Australian Telescope Compact Array in Australia. So this is actually CO 1 to 0 and 3 to 2 in two objects. It's both in the same object. No, it's both in the same object. Yes, there was another object which I didn't show. So what you can actually see with the lensing model, you can look at the difference between the CO1 to 0 and CO3 to 2. And if you then go to the source plane with your detailed lensing model, which are done consistently between the two, you can see that the CO1 to 0 is diffuse and in a much larger area. So this is a bit schematic. This with ATCA, the data is, of course, it's only 6 antennas, and you cannot do things very detailed as you would do with ALMA. But then in the higher CO transitions, well, not still not very high, but here you see two objects that are a little bit red and blue shifted. So you see that's already the difference between the diffuse CO1 to 0, the ground state, and the more denser tracer of the higher transitions. So that's, of course, a very simple thing that we did a few years ago, just in film we did there. But what we now want to do is do this in other bright lines with ALMA. Well, ALMA cannot get the ground state CO transitions in these high redshift objects, which is below band 3. But the other bright line that we have here is the C plus line. And we have some data that just came in like a month or two ago with 0.3 arc second resolution, or slightly better even, where we can actually resolve the C plus line, the bright line.
So you know the redshift of.
Yeah, that'll come. Yes. Yeah, we're doing the redshift is a lot of work, but that'll come. So but these ones we know the redshift, otherwise we cannot do target the lines, of course.
No, yes, but I mean
Yeah, that's this part here. So this is the overview of my talk where I am. All the things come together, so it's a bit difficult to put everything into by the end it'll all be clear, I hope. But what we really want to do is to do the Smith-Kennicott relation with scales of almost 100 parsecs. That's what we can do in objects at redshift 6. So that's starting to get interesting.
So 0.3 arc seconds of 6 is what, 2 kiloparsecs?
Yes, but you have the lensing stretching.
Sure.
So you can, if you have a good lensing model, you can actually go to much smaller scales.
By how much is it?
Well, it depends on the lensing configuration, how closely you are on the caustic. It can, in principle, be infinity.
Of course.
But,
but in practice, it's
more like 10 times or so of order. But I mean, that's
so it can go down to 200 parsec in that case.
Yeah. But with ALMA, you can do better than 0.3. So that was our next proposal to go to 0.1 arc seconds or so. So then you really go to this the size of the GMCs. And that's with 100 parsecs. I mean, even I think nearby galaxy people may start to find that interesting. So, and that's at redshift 6 we're doing that.
Sorry, maybe I'm missing something, but why the CO10 and the C322 have a different extension when you balance them?
This is coming from the observations themselves, because this one is tracing the more diffuse gas. Being a ground state transition of CO, this is tracing the denser, more dense gas.
But if you look at the map, they seem to be cross-spatial almost.
Look at this map and this map. This is a bit lower resolution because it was done with the other receivers, here you have the 6 kilometer baseline, and here you don't have that 6 kilometer baseline. They don't have the receivers on it. But if you then do a self-consistent model, you can actually get the data out of it. It's a bit complex, but because you need to know how the outcome actually works.
Okay. Because the extension, it seems similar, even if the resolution is better.
Yes, that's why you do the very detailed lens model. So this is the power of very detailed lens models. If you know that lens model should be consistent, you know where the caustic is, which is this diamond-shaped object here. That's the lensing caustic. So you can see where your lens and model where this, how the shape of these different peaks here in your Einstein ring would be. That's where you can then reconstruct that back towards the source plane that you get here. So it's, you cannot immediately do it, but it needs a lot of modeling to do it properly. Okay, now on the redshifts. So I'll spend a bit of time on this. That's also where I know a bit more. So this work done by a grad student of Axel Weiss, Maria Strandet in Bonn, also with a big APEX connection. So what we've done here is to go straight. I mean, what's been done before on this is,
otherwise the recording won't show much. Yep. So what was done before is like to get redshifts of these objects, you had to go to the optical. Well, first get this from arc minute scale resolution or 10 or 20 arc second scale resolution. You get the submillimeter source there. Then you did the radio follow-up, then you could identify the optical counterpart, and then you take an optical spectrum, which is not ideal because these objects are dusty and often very hard to get. So bypass the whole thing, go straight to ALMA. Well, actually, we started going with APEX first. We had an instrument brought there specifically for doing this, Z-Spec, which covered the whole of ALMA band 6 in one go. And we also got a few redshifts with that. But then when ALMA came online, we did just scanned the whole of band 3 here with 5 tunings. So basically you get lower sides and upper side band here. That's what each of the colors are doing. With 5 tunings, you have the whole band covered here. And this goes actually very quick. So ALMA is really, for sources like this, it's a really efficient redshift machine. So the good thing is you don't have to pass by, you know for sure that the objects you see, if you have some of the CO lines or the C1 lines in your spectrum, you know for sure that you have the right object, because that's the other thing. In the optical, you get lines, and are you sure it's a real object? You have to go back and get the CO lines, and then you're sure. That's like 3-4 years later. Here with ALMA, it just goes straight to it. You got it. And you, at the same time, get this high-resolution images, you know, exactly what you're looking at. So, and we started in cycle zero, then we spent 20 minutes per source. That is 20 minutes for 5 tunings on source. So, but then we thought, oh, even that is overkill. We can even do it with 2 minutes per tuning, so 10 minutes in total per source, plus the overhead, which is probably like 5 times this, but anyway. But then we get the whole sources tuned, and I would say in about an hour or so, you get a redshift of these objects with ALMA. And that's an unequivocal redshift, which already gives you a lot of signs from the lines that you have in there. So this really works very well.
Those are colors if they have the same whole spectral tuning, would that go even faster, or would you be killed by
We actually bypassed the whole thing and did it ourselves. That in the end worked.
So you're saying that is the fastest you can do.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to live with that luxury.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what could help in the future, is to have broader bandwidth. That's the only thing that could make it faster, because you really. And what also is very unfortunate for these kind of things with ALMA is. Let's see if I can just put it in here. Yeah, is that the band, the gap here, what you actually get is 3.75 gigahertz. So if that would be 4.0, would make things a lot better, because we have all this overlap here in the middle. It's because you cannot afford to lose even 100 megahertz in the middle, because if you just have your line in there, you would not know for sure if what your redshift, you really have to cover the entire band. So if the IF gap in between is 8.0, so we have to do several setups, and that's so. Anyway, 5 tunings is not too bad. I mean, if you would have these gaps removed, we could probably do it in 4 tunings. And having also an ALMA band 2 plus 3 would be better, because then you get it all done in one go. So this is illustrating a little bit how this works. So here we have redshift, and here we have the tunings, the tuning frequencies of band three. So it goes from here to here. So if you would add band two, you would extend here. Well, you cannot here you cannot extend it because you have a atmospheric absorption line. So what is on here is at each redshift, what CO line and or C1 line, which is this, these two red dotted lines, and also the water lines, because we can actually use water lines to determine redshifts. It's interesting. You can do physics with them, but you can also use them to determine redshifts. Well, same thing with CO.
Microphone.
I don't know what to do with this microphone. Yeah, it's... Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I'm not sure if it's recording anything. Anyway, so where was I? Yep. So yeah, what we have here, if you have at a certain redshift, if it's white, that means we don't have any lines in the band three. If you have yellow, you have one line when you've scanned the whole band, and if you have green, you have two or more lines in it. So you can see that here, if you're in the green thing, you have the CO4. If you're at redshift 4.5, let's say, you have the CO 4 to 3. And the C1 line and the CO5 to 4, so you have three lines, your redshift is unequivocal. Well, if you're at redshift 2.5, you only have the CO3 to 2. So if you have one line, you're not sure which one it is. It could still be CO2 to 1 or CO3 to 2. So you still have a bit of uncertainty in it. So how does this look like? Well, this is an overview from the Nature paper we had a few years ago by Joaquin Vieira. An overview of the different redshifts we had in here. So sometimes we have multiple lines. Actually, ironically, the higher redshift makes it easier because that's when we get more of the lines in that band. If you go to a lower redshift, so that's these objects are sorted in redshift, as you can see. Then you have one line. So you can see here, for example, there's one line, CO3 to 2. I'll come back how we know that CO3 to 2. And then in this certain redshift here, we just clumped them here. There's a few objects where we just saw a continuum but no lines. So. So this is how the data, the real data looks like. So I mean, they almost look like optical spectra. I mean, I've done optical spectroscopy before, and some of you have done too, but looks pretty similar almost. So you see lines here and here, but then sometimes you have just this one line. Well, this one is with one line, that one is with one line. So how do we know the redshift of these? Okay, so this is where we went. We took the SED here with all our different points that we had in here. And then from the ones with known redshifts, took a dust temperature distribution. So this is like a probability diagram of the different distributions. So if you have one line, you know it can
based
be
on what?
Sorry?
Based on what?
Based on the ones where we have several lines. So we know for sure, because what if you have one line, you could say, oh, why don't you just use this? Well, you have the temperature redshift degeneracy between the objects here, because if you have a cooler object or a higher redshift object, it will look the same. So it's 1 plus z divided by t dust, that is constant. So, but we can use the information that if our sample is drawn from the same population, that the dust temperature should be roughly equal, sort of have the same distribution. So by now we have enough redshifts that are confirmed with by multiple lines that we can make this distribution, and so the peak is around 40 Kelvin. So okay, if you do this, and then you get for each of the ones where we have only one line, you have a for each of the options of this line. Sometimes you have three options, sometimes you only have two different options, because then the other options you would have seen a second line. If it's a high redshift, you would have seen. So there's only normally if it's 0.3 to 2 or. Or 4 to 3 or 2 to 1, that's the most likely option. So for example, here, it's clearly that the most likely distribution with the dust temperatures would put it at redshift 3.8. So that's then our photometric redshift. So this is not a solid redshift. We don't call that a solid, I mean, we don't call that a reliable redshift, but we use it as an indicator for our follow-up. So it was like, well, the first option we will check is this redshift option 3.8. And if that doesn't work, we'll check the 5.1 or the 2.6. So that actually has been quite useful. I mean, it doesn't always work, but it really has made the follow-up a lot easier. So the follow-up that we've done to find a second line in these one-liners is done with five different telescopes. I'll very quickly go through this. One what we did in cycle one was to follow up from our cycle zero observations, where we knew what to look. There was two options. So we did this with ALMA itself. And of course, that works. You have a bright line here or here where you expect it to be. So that really works 100% certain. It only it takes 2 years to go through, and you need to go back to ALMA. And sometimes you have to then actually tune somewhere with ALMA where you know you wouldn't see any lines. So it's not the most efficient use of ALMA, because you knew that some of them would not work. The other option is to use ATCA. So that works for the 0.1 to 0 or 2 to 1. It only works at certain redshifts, because certain redshifts, they don't have receivers where you would expect the lines to be. At the time when Herschel was still flying, we actually got a few confirmations with Herschel's Spire FDS spectroscopy. That also doesn't work anymore. We also did this with VLT, where we got the Lyman alpha lines or some other lines. Again, that depends on the dust, the source not being too dusty. But what is really the best way to do is use APEX. And this is really where the synergy between ALMA and APEX excels, is by using APEX as the follow-up instrument of ALMA. People think of it the other way around, but this is really where APEX is doing the follow-up of ALMA. We really solve ALMA redshift degeneracies. So with the flash instrument on APEX, we've got the C plus lines very easily detected in a few hours. That'll come back to that part of the talk. But we've also used the new Sapia Band 5 receiver, which we already have a Band 5 receiver that ALMA does not have yet. We've been doing science with it for more than a year already now. And it's also so flash. So with these two instruments, we've actually confirmed mostly with the C plus lines with flash and the mid JCO lines with the Sapia. So once ALMA has these bands, we can also do this with ALMA. But APEX is a lot quicker on feedback, especially if you have people in Max Planck who have MPIFR mostly, but who have a lot of access to APEX. It's quite easy to do this follow up.
So I have a question.
Yep.
So if APEX were to cover the whole 3 millimeter band in one go, would it have been faster to use APEX to follow up the sources?
3 millimeter is not.
Or whatever band, so you have.
Yes, well, we've actually done that with C-SPEC. The problem with C-SPEC was that band 6 is what we covered at APEX. And at these, I'll come back to the redshift distribution, but at the high redshift distribution is actually where you don't expect many lines in band 6, because they're all redshifted out. So you go to J of 10 CO lines, which may, and it's not high enough redshift, high enough frequency to get the C plus lines. So band 3 is a bit of that sweet spot where we have all the CO lines in it. Now, why doesn't APEX have a band 3 receiver? Well, at low frequencies, that's where a single dish telescope loses a little bit in collecting area. So APEX works well at high frequencies, but at low frequencies, it's a bit harder. It's a single small telescope.
So you're saying LM2 would be better?
Yes, yeah, because you need collecting area. Yeah, that's where they have such an instrument, the redshift search receiver RSR, and that is pretty obvious for it. And EMIR on the 30 meter is also doing this.
But it's wrong hemisphere.
Yes, for these objects, it is the wrong hemisphere, and ironically. This is exactly what you wanted to do. Talking about the C-SPEC, so I mentioned it a few times at APEX. So we had, this is actually one of our brightest sources, if not the brightest sources. It's like, it was selected to be 50 millijanskis at 1.4 millimeters. It was like almost half a jansky with Herschel. So this is really very bright, half a jansky object. This turns out to be, well, don't have the redshift yet, so let's put it historically, keep the pressure going up. well, I can tell you this source has really annoyed us for a long time. So we did it with APEX, with C-SPEC for 6 hours. We got a very nice continuum detection, very high signal to noise, but no believable lines. We first thought this could be something, this could be something. So this is 190 to 310 gigahertz in one go. So, but this was a bit of a complex instrument to use. It was cooled down. It was it operated at 80 millikelvins, and that with wet helium up on 5,000 meters is not easy, I can tell you. so we didn't get it. So we actually searched the higher frequency band with the flash instrument. So we covered 295, which overlaps a bit here, up to 354, and that's where we ended. Still nothing. So in the end, we put it in cycle 3 with ALMA, and lo and behold, whopping lines there, redshift 4.3, which seems high, but when you see the rest, it's not that high. So what happened is that that was the redshift, and that puts the C plus line at 355.3. So here, so we just didn't scan enough. It's like, oh, yeah. So that's what happens. But this is much better. So this is currently our record holder, redshift 6.9. I think that's starting to get interested. This is not published yet, so it will be a paper by Maria Strandet in Bonn. So this is the ALMA spectrum. So you saw a line here, a line, and actually a complex of two lines here. There was a remaining redshift degeneracy if these two lines had a velocity shift. So we went to ATCA and got the CO3 to two line easily confirmed. So this is redshift 6.9, no question about it. And this is a bright source. So this is this is recent, so it's not published yet. So we're still working on the follow up of this. Now, the redshift distribution. This is actually the same thing. So this is from the paper from Maria Strandet that just came out on SPH about 2 months ago. And this is updated with our cycle 3 redshift that came after, so the last few weeks almost. So the distribution, basically what you see here in orange lined out is what you see here. And cycle 3, you added a little bit more, so we added our redshift 6.9 object, but otherwise it doesn't really change anymore. We now have solid redshift, like multiple lines, for 59 sources. So I think we're starting to get to a point where you can have proper, reliable redshift distributions of these sources. So our median redshift here is marked here with the red arrow. It's 3.9. So for those of you who've worked on these sources before, you may have remembered that the Scott Chapman 2005 paper said the median redshift of these objects is 2.3 or 2.5. Well, these objects, it's 3.9. So that's significantly higher.
So how do you explain that?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm going to do. So they're lensed. So to lens objects, that does introduce a bit of a bias. Mm-hmm. If they're below redshift 2, they cannot be lensed because if the lenses are on average on redshift 1 and your object is at redshift 1.5, you don't amplify it properly. It needs to have at least a unit in redshift behind it. So that's the probability of amplification as a function of redshift, taking into account the redshift distribution of the lenses, which we have from optical spectroscopy of the lenses, which I didn't even show. But so this, you can do this if you take a size, if you assume the sizes are constant, there's no size evolution of these objects. So redshift 7 object has the same size as a redshift 2 object, which is a bit of an assumption. So this is actually an intrinsic uncertainty, which is why I am personally against de-magnifying redshift distributions, because I think this is skewing things and putting a model in an observed distribution. The paper did it a little bit against my will, so now I'm.
Sorry,
the others are not here.
Mm-hmm. Could you repeat this?
Yeah. So if you have a size, if high redshift objects, redshift 7, are smaller than redshift 2 objects or intermediate objects, then your lensing probability will change because smaller objects are more likely to be lensed because you have to be near the caustic and you magnify them more strongly. So to make a redshift, a probability of lensing as a function of redshift with the same redshift distribution of the lensing galaxy, the foreground objects, you need to assume that the sizes also evolve or remain constant. So what we've done here is to assume that there is no evolution. The redshift 7 object is the same size as the redshift 2 object. That may not be true, but yeah. So this is why it's and there's going to be scatter in it. So whenever you take source by source, on a statistical basis, this may work to some extent, but on a source by source basis, you cannot really do that. Unless you have a very detailed lens model, then you can do it. So for redshift distribution, I think this is dangerous to do.
Okay.
But assuming there is no size evolution, that could actually have shifted up our lens, median redshift by up to 0.8. So if you turn it around, that was in Axel Weiss' paper from 2013, look at the difference between our redshift distribution and the redshift distribution, for example, from the LESS survey or from previous surveys, you would need a size evolution of more than a factor of 5. So redshift 7 objects need to be a factor of 5 smaller than redshift 2 objects. which starts beginning a bit extreme.
What is your selection frequency? It's 1 million.
1.4. That's indeed. That's what I think is the real thing. It's the selection wavelength. So this is what work done with Mathieu Betermin. So this is the same distribution here, which is then repeated here. But this was based on our cycle zero redshift from Axel Weiss' paper. So it hasn't really changed that much, but just to keep in mind why this and this is different. So this is basically a selection wavelength first Herschel Pax at 100 microns, 250, 450, 850, 1.1 millimeters, and 1.4 millimeters. So you can see the colored histograms are the redshift distribution here. So you can see that this thing shifts more and more towards higher redshift if you go to longer selection wavelength, which is what you would expect for being on the Rayleigh-Jeans distribution of these objects. This was done with this empirical model that Mathieu has done. It has both main sequence, which is the dominating part, and starburst in it. You run through, there's a few other effects, like also the limiting magnitude and so forth that go into this. I mean, I won't go into all the details of this. But so what you have here is the observed distribution in color, and the black thing is what his model predicts. I mean, I think the distribution between the models and the observed distributions is pretty close, and that's not fitted. That's just how his models predict it. There's no fine-tuning done in this. So I think the difference in redshifts on that it is an effect of the selection wavelength is a pretty solid statement, I think, by now, that it's really the dominating effect. So there were a few people like who has worked on the old things that were trying to say, oh, yeah, but it must be the lensing that is dominating. No, I don't think it's the lensing. It's really the selection wavelength that is the dominating part. So I think this is, we're quite definitively settling this question.
So why is there a peak?
Peak in the redshift?
Yeah.
Well, depends a bit if you call it a peak. I would rather call it a plateau for redshift 2 to 5, because it's, well, I mean, I don't think this is statistically, if you bid it a little bit differently, it wouldn't look as much as a peak anymore. But while there's nothing below redshift 2 is a lensing bias, that we don't have objects here, that's a lensing bias. That we don't find a high redshift, well, that, I think it's rather high redshift drop off at some point.
In principle, so it's not that the SAR is incomplete in that sense?
No.
Or?
No. I think it's at some point we started to hit where these objects exist. So I think at redshift 7, there are not as many objects as at redshift 5.
Is that also an issue that the dust temperatures are still changing or evolving?
That shouldn't matter too much at 1.4 millimeters.
Yeah, but the longer wavelengths, maybe it's biased to the hotter dust.
Colder, really 1.4 millimeter. That's why this works better at high, because here, I mean, here it's very, I mean, these Herschel frequencies, this is where you're really very critically depending on the temperatures, much more than at the long frequency, because here it's safely, even at redshift 7, you're safely in the Rayleigh-Jeans scale.
So, sorry, come back to the second part of my question. So when you say that the data agree with the model being corrected for the lensing bias and the redshift, but at high redshift, this is what they predict?
Yes, exactly. This actually has the lensing in it.
All right.
Yeah, this has lensing, assuming no size evolution again.
Okay.
That's, yeah, there is a bit of an assumption in there, but this is, if you assume no size evolution, that redshift 7 and redshift 2 and redshift 5 objects are all the same size statistically, then you can explain it all with just the selection wavelength bias.
So the fact that the model predicts that there are essentially no objects beyond redshift 6, is it due to, or what is in the model, what is the reason in the model for which?
Well, they need to perform at some point.
Is it temperature? Well, I don't know, this is just the NTC, right?
Yeah.
Is it the number?
Yeah, so I mean, also just
not the star formation density, what I'm saying. So
yes, no, that also comes.
So is the number of objects, basically. So what is the reason? I mean, I'm trying to understand what is the physics in the model that says that you cannot have anything beyond 6.
Yeah, well, this has the evolution, this model has the intrinsic evolution of the main sequence in it, because it's mostly main sequence galaxies. So indeed, at redshift 7, there are fewer objects than at redshift 5. Or at redshift 4, I mean, but and at redshift 10 there's even fewer. So the fact that we've only our 60th object or 50th object rather, was at redshift 7. It took us a while to get there. So, and we're more than half of our objects, we all have redshifts for it. So it's not that there's many lurking, there's many redshifts, 8 or 9 objects in our remaining to be discovered. I mean, we're like 60% of our sources have solid redshifts, and a few of them still have single line redshifts already, which we know they're not going to be at redshift 8.
But the number density predicted, because this is the number, I understand you normalize it to your sample, but in terms of number density of these sources at redshift, say 6, what is it?
I would have to look at, I don't have it on the top of my head.
Okay.
But,
I try to understand if they are extremely rare, like quasars.
Yes, they are very rare.
They are at the level of quasars.
Well, I mean, no, it depends on how strongly they're lensed. Right?
Sure.
If they're lensed by a factor of 30, we're going to much more intrinsically more normal objects and more frequent objects. But this is all taken into account with lensing probability distribution. So this is somehow folded into these models already. So that means that it cannot be that wrong because it all fits other unlensed samples too.
No, I'm not saying that it's wrong. I just have to understand why it's, I mean, the trend, and therefore also the number of these areas. I try to make to understand what is the number density of these, how rare they are.
I mean, to have them lensed like this, they are rare because this is the only reason why we found them is that our survey is 2,500 square degrees. It's a huge area of the sky that we look in. Otherwise, you wouldn't have found these rare objects.
So these are really extremely strange things.
If they're lensed, yes. The combination of these objects plus the lensing makes them rare. But intrinsically, they're not necessarily that rare. That's the whole point. What I wanted to say is that they're relatively normal objects, but thanks to the lensing, we can study them. But to have this combination of lensing plus an object, they need to be intrinsically also relatively bright. I mean, I won't deny that, but they're not really, the few objects that are unlensed, they are really extreme. They're the most extreme objects in the universe almost. So, but yeah, as I say, it's difficult to prove that they're unlensed. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Okay, so moving on a bit more of the physical follow-up. And so starting with the C+ line survey, done by Bitten Goldberg, who now moved to Durham. And so here with Flash, I mean, I briefly showed already, in a few hours, we get easy detections of the C+ line. So you don't need ALMA to get the C+ line, to just detect it, a line, to just use APEX for in a few hours to get it. So what's overlaid here is the ALMA CO lines at the same velocity scale so that you can actually see that it's really the right line. So what we've done plotted here is the C+ over far infrared luminosity against the far infrared luminosity. So I think Roberto Maiolino was one of the first ones showing this when the C+ detections were coming in. So what we saw, and that was also seen in the black objects, are the nearby objects, the low Z galaxies. I think this is mostly from the Brouwer sample that was also mentioned this morning. So the red objects here are the SPT sources. The blue objects are other high redshift objects, with the green, the AGNs marked separately. So the first thing that shows by just looking at the plot is that the error bars here are much smaller. That's because this is lensed objects, so you get much higher signal noise, very well determined SEDs, pretty good signal noise C+ lines compared to some other objects. So here's the histogram of these objects. So what was seen is that these the most luminous sources are actually fainter in C+ than the intrinsic. So with a bit of a change at around 10 to 11 solar masses luminosity, so that those objects are fainter. And especially the AGN-dominated sources, they're never on this track seen in low redshift objects, so they're all below it. So the distribution here in red of the SPT sources is consistent with the other sources, but with less scatter. So you can do things a bit better with good signal to noise. Now, looking at this a little bit more into detail, what we realize is that so this is again the same plot, but now plotted the same value with C+ over far infrared luminosity, but here plotted against the dust temperature. Because we know the redshift, we can get the dust temperature out of it. So you see clearly a trend, this decrement goes down, I mean, the decrement becomes more pronounced, or the C+ becomes fainter for the hottest objects. Well, the warmer objects, I would say. I wouldn't call 60 Kelvin hot. But then this is actually just the Stefan Boltzmann law, because that's at least the dominating factor in it. The far field velocity goes with temperature 2^4. If you take that out, your correlation is mostly gone. So here you see it in the red points, there's no real correlation left anymore. So the whole thing of a deficit from loss, deficit with things with far field velocity is just the Stefan Boltzmann law. So. Well, there's a few other things in it, but that's the normal proportionality. It's
t to the sixth, then does it change if you scale?
Well, yeah, but this is just pure physics, right?
Yeah, but does total luminosity doesn't scale with t to the fourth, t to the fourth plus beta?
Yes, well, that's assuming if you have the same dust distribution for all of them, because you're comparing from one to the other, right?
No, this is about the just relay regime of
yeah, that's a relay genes, right? Yeah.
No, relay scatter, so relay collages, and you have to have a correction on that. Mm-hmm. So you'll have a scale like T25 or whatever, it's a question of opacity.
So it's just not optically thick.
Yes, it's not optically thick.
It's not optical thickness.
It becomes optically thick.
A relation between size of the dust and wavelengths, which we measure.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It becomes optically thick. What's what we've got from the lensing models? At around 140 microns rest frame, not 100, what most people assume, but it's around 140. Not that it matters much, but that's what we got from our own data. So this is mostly determined from the optically thin part still.
Mm-hmm. But would that explanation also for the other far infrared emission lines deficit?
Because unless those lines also have dust temperature dependence on them, that could do other things. But because you're dividing this thing by far infrared luminosity. So if you take, this is what you should be looking at. You should take out your far infrared luminosity dependence before you start looking at if there's any deficit. I mean, what is obvious still here is the green points here, the HNs are warmer. Yeah, not too unexpectedly, I would say. So.
But your sources are at different temperatures, right?
Yes, well, that's what you can see here in the X-ray.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they are not sensitive only to the warmer or hotter dust component. So if you get back to the previous slide. So in this case, if you consider your data points, they're still marginally on the lower side.
Yeah, they're marginally lower. They're not as low as some of the other objects here. Yeah, but look at the error bars of these objects.
No.
They're really very uncertain. I mean, this was pre-ALMA work, I would say. But what is interesting, I mean, I'm very interested in this thing of what the other lines do. So I think that's now the end of my talk. I want to do this with the other fine structure lines. So that is what I really are after, is to see what the other fine structure lines do. But the other thing that you could do is compare the C plus and the CO 1:0. So I'll show later we have CO 1:0 or 2:1 for most of these objects from ATCA, but at least from about 20 of them from the initial part. So what you can see is that the red points here is where that we don't have lots of scatter. So this is just the one sigma scatter around this object. So if you compare this with all the local objects, they scatter all over the place. All of the other objects, they scatter along like one order of magnitude in C plus over CO ratio. But our objects are quite a compact band of these objects of the C plus over CO ratio. So why is that? So we went back to some of the original papers, even from Crawford, 1985, and so forth, and trying to understand this. In the end, we went back to what we ended up is the plain source function. So just directly where you get the emission from. So the C plus and the CO just goes with cubed. That was the first thing we thought, oh, maybe C plus, people always said it's optically thin. Well, maybe it isn't. And if it is optically thick, then this term goes away. If they have the same temperatures, this goes away, and then you would to do the four temperatures of original idea, but it's a bit more complex than that.
Sorry, but this assumes that both lines come from the same physical region.
That's exactly what we found, that they are not.
Okay.
that was the first. I mean, this does not assume anything. But if these things are the same, then you, then they goes, this goes away. So I skipped a number of plots in here, but we can already show that if, well, we know the optical depth of CO from the 12 to 13 CO ratio in a few of our objects. And I mean, CO is optically thick. I don't think most people deny that. So we know that this, at least this, this bottom term will go away because this, this is very, very big. So we don't know the optical depth of C plus, which is what we would like to know. To really determine it unequivocally, you have to look at the 12 to 13 C plus ratio, which even in galactic objects, this is pretty tough because they're only like a few hundred or 100 kilometers per second away, and the intrinsic line width is more than that. So it becomes very difficult to get an independent determination on this. So if you have the same temperature, excitation temperature of CO and C plus, then we cannot explain. I didn't put a plot on, unfortunately. Or is it this one? No. Yeah, I had one where you could have done. Yeah, actually, no. That's not this one. Yeah, but I skipped that one. But they cannot come from the same reason because they would be completely. Well, and if you add in the factor that the opacity factor of CO, then you can show that it's impossible with the observed line ratios for the CO and the C plus coming from the same region. So something like a PDR kind of structure is independently from our data without any other assumptions. We can confirm that you do need the different origin, the different excitation temperatures of CO and C+. So we actually, the excitation temperature of CO, you can also get an idea of this. If you, for example, you take them in thermal equilibrium between the CO and the dust, you can take the dust temperature. So for example, if you do 35 or 40, as a Kelvin temperature, that's what we've done here. And then you see what, from the observed ratio here, what would you expect with different opacities of optically thin C plus and optically thick, well, almost thick CO. That would be this dotted line here. So then you would have excitation temperature of C plus of a few hundred. Started to get a bit on the high side, but it cannot really be excluded. If you have both similar opacity that you get here, and if you get the more, well, the other option is that the C plus has optically thick, is, well, almost optically thick, around one, and the CO is around four in optical depth, which is quite a realistic value. Actually, it doesn't matter too much between these two values if they have them both equal, and it doesn't matter which one it is, because then they would just cancel out here. Then you get excitation temperature around 90 Kelvin, which interestingly is just the and it corresponds with the ionization potential of the C plus line. So basically what we could say is that optically thick or almost optically thick tau equals one of C plus is still consistent with the data, which is not what people have been saying before. So I think this is should be taken into account that C plus is not always optically thin. So that's what we really want to say. Not if you put it into this Stacey diagram, at least at Harvard, if you call it the Stacey diagram. It's basically the C plus and CO against both normalized by Fermi-Philipp luminosity, which for our point of view is useful because you, the lensing factor goes out in this case. And then compare it with PDR models here. So this it gives you also an idea of what kind of G naught factors we have. So I'm not, I don't get excited by G naughts of 400. I mean, we're probably more like a few thousands. But these are, of course, integrated over full galaxies. So
I have a super naive question, which is, you know, if your tau is zero or your tau is one, every C plus photon that you emit comes out, right?
Tau equals one?
Tau equals one, I mean, you
I'm
just,
getting a
it's
little
just
bit.
An effective scattering, right?
Yeah. Well, tau equals one is like the borderline case, right?
No, but this is not tau one.
That's
plus, right?
Average.
It's tau one in the line, right?
Yeah, that's
so
the C
that
plus
means
line.
You just effectively scatter the photon.
Yes.
So all the photons still come out. So why does the luminosity change? I mean, I understand in a very optically thick system, then there's a finite photon diffusion time, but that's not the case here.
Well.
So,
Tarkos one, I don't think it's every single photon. I mean, it's what is it? It's 2.5 times that you're reducing it, so it's not.
No, if you're absorbing, that's true. But I thought you're just scattering here.
scattering? Is it the carbon too scattering?
Meaning, so you just absorb it, and doesn't it get re-emitted?
Well, it could be re-emitted as dust, of course. I mean, if it's absorbed by dust grains.
But this is absorbed by carbon two atoms, right? You're talking about optical depth in carbon two. So it's just like Lyman alpha scattering or something, right? You absorb and then you re-emit.
Yeah, but
it's all forbidden transition.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, you put it in an excited state, and then it goes. It will re-emit the photon, no?
No, collisional is excited.
It's conditionally de-excited faster than it can creatively. That would make sense.
Yeah.
I think that this is absorbed by dust. It's not absorbed by carbon.
No, I think it's talking about optical depth in carbon two. Right?
Yeah, that's the carbon two that goes in here. Yes, that is of the carbon two. But they're in a medium that would be hopefully in pressure equilibrium. So I mean,
but
the whole
can be collisionally de-excited faster than
It's forbidden. I think this is it's not like the Lyman alpha where it's just so rapid they can stay there.
But I mean, forbidden, you know, 21 centimeters is forbidden too. So it just depends on the excitation.
In fact,
the
ratio is always three, the degeneracy is always three. All the electrons are in the upper state in the hyperfine levels of 21 centimeter, right? And so I guess it's something like that. The thing is that there, the optical depth becomes large because so many hydrogen atoms.
But that does mean that what you see as C plus is not necessarily tracing the full mass of it. You have a chance that you're starting to miss a bit. It's like using CO. People use 13 CO for gas mass tracers, right?
Oh, I see.
Because
so
it's not really thin.
Okay.
Yeah. It's when you want to use C plus as a mass tracer, it's no longer as good. That's what I meant.
Okay.
Yeah,
I could see
that. Yeah. Yep. So kind of mentioned this thing that's worked by Manuel Araveda now and Diego Portales in Chile. So we got all the low JCO lines here. So what we've done here is also the depletion times of these objects, where our objects are here, the fat dotted lines, and this is the main sequence. So these things go, what you see is the depletion times. Well, there's big uncertainties because you have to do an alpha CO assumption in here. But at high redshift, they don't seem to be going any higher. So if anything, the depletion times go a little bit shorter at the highest redshifts. So that's interesting. And this, again, I should say, this is of order 10 hours with ATCA, where other high redshift objects, people have tried 50 hours on it and they've got like a 3-4 sigma detection. This is like 10 sigma in a few hours. So it's really, gravitational lensing makes your telescope a lot bigger and life a lot easier. What else was there? I should speed up a little bit. Other lines. So what we did in the beginning, that was done by Justin Spilker also in the 2014 paper, took all the ALMA band 3 spectra, stacked them. So here's the number of objects stacked. That's a bit of redshift, and we should do this again now we have new redshifts. But this, well, of course, you see the 12 CO lines, that's easy. But we also seen some other lines. We've seen the 13 CO lines, hence the optical depth of CO is intrinsically determined in our object. So it's around optical depth of 4 or 5. But we've also seen like HGN, HNC, where are they? Here. This one is just an HGN 6 to 5 line that we've got detected in our stack spectrum. It's one of the deeper parts of it. The HGO plus lines, all these high, really high density tracers. Some of the objects, we have them individually detected, but in the stack spectrum, you can do a little bit more. You shouldn't exaggerate the usefulness of a stacked spectrum of this. For example, doing proper COSELD modeling on a stack spectrum does not make much sense because you should do it separately and then do it. But still, it gives you an idea of what would be the detectability of objects. And this was a bit of a starter for something which is not out yet, because this is just data we just got. This is a band 3 and band 4 study of a few hours per object at different tunings. Of two objects at redshift 5.7, which were conveniently very close to each other that we could see them together. So you see the red and the blue are two different objects. So the CO 8 to 7 lines, they're very different in power, because this is just offset a little bit, but you can see the line to continuum ratio varies a lot in these objects. Here, this water line is very strong in this object, but in that object, it's barely detected. Very interesting is like this OH line here, and there's another one here. This one is an emission, and here is an absorption.
Sorry, do you have any insight on the source of excitation of the CO827? I mean, if you think that shocks are the causing the...
We are, well...
an X-ray source?
Well, we need more SELDs. So this is not necessarily the source where we have the most lines. We have, that's work that Bitten Goldberg is working on. We have at least one object where we have 6 or 7 CO lines where you can start doing these things, because that still takes a lot of time. It's an individual tuning for all of them. And some of these things are not cannot be done by ALMA. This is not necessarily the best object for it, because we don't necessarily have it. Yeah, but most likely we will need some XDR or CRDRs also in these objects. But this looks bright, but that's just because this is a few hours with ALMA. It's not necessarily that bright. If you go deep enough, you will see even a faint 8-7 line. This is ALMA on a very bright lens object. This is.
But how common is it to get a waterline?
Actually, that's not that hard. We've seen quite a number of waterlines, especially this particular line. The 201, whatever the telephone number is. This is one of the almost ground state. This is the 950 or 942 gigahertz line. So this one is, well, actually you can see this is in rest frequency, 980, whatever it is, 985 or so. So this is actually one of the brightest water lines. We've even seen ionized water lines in this object next to it. And that was in band 3, which is not shown here, but yeah, just we have not analyzed this yet. This is just new data, and we're expecting a few more tunings here in the middle that have not been observed yet. So this is really preliminary. We need the full thing. But just looking at two objects, I mean, these OH lines and absorption of the water here and there. So it's not something that is standard in it. I mean, as you can see, I mean, this is one out of two has it, the other one doesn't. But we've seen it in just the shorter spectra too. So, okay, and quickly a few others. This is a paper from Mathieu Bentemin, came out last year. So the N2, and actually that's really high JCO, that's 12 to 11. So we're in the same tuning. Well, you could start comparing the C+ and the N2 with PDR models, but the problem is, of course, you have to look also at the H2 to PDR ratio in these objects. So that's kind of what was here, the schematical thing. So if you are high enough up, then you could assume that the C+, you can actually start doing some work on it, because then it's no longer dominated by the ratio. These things are all H2 dominated sources, if I got it right. But if they're then PDR dominated in the C+, you could start looking a bit at the metallicity sequences. This is to be confirmed a bit. This was work from Toru Nagao, who has done these kind of models in it. If this is true, I mean, and these here are the Hercules sample, the nearby objects, then this object is amongst the lower metallicity objects, but it depends a lot on for example, the density. I mean, that's these two scales that you have here. So it could be half solar, but it could still be a little bit super solar if you go to higher density. So, I mean, this needs more lines to do it properly, but just to say that it would be consistent with objects like these. We have the N2 line to look at, to use this as a metallicity tracer in its beginning. So what we're planning to do is to do a proper N+ survey of all objects, do it not on one or two objects, but doing it on 30 objects or so. Even the ACA can detect these objects easily. From this particular one, I think this is about arcsecond. Okay. Yeah. Also from our spectroscopy, our redshift searches is about.
Are you planning to go to higher spatial resolution to really start to see this?
On case by case basis, yes. To do it on all of our
distribution, I mean,
yes.
At least to some level at low.
Yes. Yes, we have that object that was here. This is this redshift 6.7 object. 5.8. That one we already have the spatially resolved C plus. We have 01146 in it, but it's also spatially resolved. We were trying to get the 0163 micron, but that wasn't observed yet, unfortunately. I think we got the N2205 or 122. So it depends on redshift to redshift which lines. But we're doing what we're generally doing is doing a few objects in all possible lines, and then do it orthogonal, do all the fine structure lines in all objects, all the one that can, so to see the trends of it. One of the fine structure lines that Jan didn't mention this morning was the C1 line. Well, not much, because it's not in the park spans, of course. So this is a paper that is almost submitted by Matt Bothwell. So that comes from our ALMA BED3 spectra, the redshift discovery spectra. So you see, it's not always very high signal to noise because this is 2 minutes per tuning. So in 2 minutes with ALMA, you see something like that already in the C1 line. Just so that this is indeed a bright line, quite not maybe not as bright as CO in all the case. You have two of those lines, and this is, well, thus far we have, how much was it, 15 objects with that line detected, of order 15, I forget the final number. So this one I should leave mostly for the discussion on Friday. It's a bit of an introduction of it. You can start thinking about it, but so what we've done is combine the C1 lines with the C2 and the ground state CO and put these into this 3D PDR model. So it's a next generation of PDR models that does it a little bit more. This is done by Thomas Bisbas and others at UCL and now at MPE. So what it would mean is, and that we'll come back to on Monday, on Friday, use that as an alternative H2 tracer to get a new alpha CO determination, because if you go the other way around. But some of the uncertainties on the abundance of the C1, but then you have the same thing if you do it with CO. A different uncertainty, but in the end, it's pretty similar. And then there's also two lines, and this is what I would just want to mention. This is not an SPD source, this is a radio galaxy. And here you can see the upper C1 line, it's actually 2 to 1 instead of 1 to 2, compared with CO7 to 6. Normally you would assume the CO7 to 6 to be brighter. Here it's completely the opposite. This is the C1 line, and this thing, little bump underneath, is the CO7 to 6, and it's in two different objects. So this, the C1 can be a lot brighter than the CO in certain cases. So that could be that it's very excited. I think if you really want to use C1, you should have both the lines detected, and that's exactly what we're doing with APEX. So here are a few first detections again of the same lines, the CO7 to 6, which is brighter than the C1 in this case, unlike the other one. But sometimes they're equal, almost equal flux. This was done with SHIFI, but now with Sepia we can do this. This is much more sensitive, and there's a new 230 GHz receiver coming on APEX. Well, it's okay, it's there already. It's being commissioned and starting science operations now. So we're doing a survey especially in this redshift range where we have both these, we already have the CO1 to 0 and now the 2 to 1 line. So if you have both the C1 lines, you could really start using this as an additional tracer. So almost done. So other fine structure lines we're planning, I kind of said this already, by having that many objects covering a large redshift range, you have lots of lines shifting through. So this is a bit of a composite where you have all the CO lines in here and the C1 lines in here, also here. Then you have the N2 lines, we're here at 205 and 122. You have the oxygen lines, the C plus line. But what people should keep in mind, that C plus line is always used as the brightest fine structure line. But it's not fainter than the 0388 micron or the 0163 microns. It's just that these two lines are hard to get. Though, if you have objects with lots of bright objects above redshift 4 or 5 and up to out of 7, these lines shift into ALMA band. So one of the things with this, you could do in band 9 and band 10. This one you could do in band 7 or 8. So you can start doing proper things with these bright fine structure lines. So that's what we're hoping to do next. I mean, this one, being so bright, we could even try it with Apex. Should work. Principle.
Apex to what, right, Jim?
Apex now has a Band 9 receiver on it, so it's still a DSB receiver. It's a copy of the Alma receiver, but we're going to get a 2SB receiver, meaning separating the sidebands. So that's out to 722 gigahertz. We even go a little bit further than
the Oxygen 3.
Yes, and go down. So it's redshift for the Oxygen 1, but Alma you can do down to redshift 4.2, from 4.2 up to, what is it, 6? You can do with Alma bands 5 and 6, 9 and 10. And then the Oxygen 3 can be done mostly in band 8. Eight and then 9 for the lower redshift object. Yeah, so that.
There is also this, I mean, the young work, but also the paper from Inoue, which pointed out that the indomitability galaxies, I don't know if this is the case for your example, I don't know, but the Oxygen 3 is especially really.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's a very promising line, the Oxygen 3. It, of course, it needs high excitation, but it's a very promising line. So one should not underestimate the other. Shouldn't only concentrate on C+, because that's what a bit of the high redshift community just, oh, fine circle line, that's C+. No, there's a lot more physics to be done with the other lines, and C+, O3, and 0163 microns are the trio.
Probably, well, yeah. We don't know if it's the most prominent, but zero level, it should be, in some sense, right?
Well, it's being the longest wavelength is what made it so, the longest wavelength of the bright lines. That's what made it so popular. But I mean, ALMA is a submillimeter telescope also, so we should be using it as a submillimeter telescope and should be looking at those lines because a lot of physics that needs to be done. So just because I'm basically done here, I think what should keep in mind is that like I actually did such an 0163 micron proposal and I was looking at, well, I said, well, initially I just want to detect them, and I think there's one line that has actually been detected with Apex, with Zeus 2. It's a broadband spectrograph that Gordon Sayce is building, so they have one detection which is to be on its way to be published, so that would be the first 0.1 detection at high redshift. But I said, like, well, let's just do directly 20 of them. So I'm just not bothering with just one object and let's show the potential of this line. Let's just do it statistically right away. With a sample like this, you want to do it properly from the start. So when I was doing this, I said, like, I just want to detect the lines. I don't want to initially spatially resolve them. Let's not do too much at the same time. And then I looked at the lowest spatial resolution I could get in band 10. That's 0.5 arcseconds. So I will spatially resolve it, and then with lensing stretching, I'll be going down to like half a kiloparsec scale. So I think they're starting to get comparable to low redshift galaxies, or even doing better. That's at redshift 6 or 7.
So, yeah, with the lens in between. Right?
With the lensing helping, yeah. But we will be able, soon we will get better data at redshift 7 than at local universe on that line. I mean, that, if you can get ALMA with higher things, you can go down to below 0.1. You can do 50 milliarcsecond resolution in band 10 if you want. And then you can go easily to 100 parsec resolution in these Oxygen 1 lines. Sure. So there's a lot of potential at objects like this.
But would that still work from the surface brightness?
Well, it's lensing conserved surface brightness. Yeah. Well, we've gone down to a few hundred parsecs in the C plus line.
No, I'm not questioning that you get rescued. I only wonder if the objects you're after.
Well, we've detected them down to a few hundred parsec resolution intrinsically after lensing correction with the C plus line in our redshift 5.8 object. I didn't show those data yet because they're still working on it. It was a bit early to show that, but that we have a spatial results with Kennicott law. Can probably show it on the screen, maybe not openly yet, but this looks pretty you do pixel by pixel lens reconstruction, so.
Okay, well, yeah. Thank you very much.